I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, Pearl Harbor Day, the day that will live in infamy, December 7, and all things political is coming up this hour of the program. All Things Political is a regular feature of our weekly lineup, always heard Mondays at 1 o'clock. And our guest this hour is the political columnist for the Des Moines Register. Kathy Obradovich is joining us. She's been in that position since 2009, covering Iowa state government politics, the Iowa caucuses. She also helped moderate the most recent Democratic presidential debate in Iowa. And you will recall that was right after the terrorist events in Paris and everything had to change. She has a very interesting column, which we'll get to sometime during this hour, about how they had to completely reformat the whole structure of that particular debate. We have a lot to talk about this hour. Of course, we'll start with the presidential address last night. President Obama, who has been criticized for underestimating the threat of terrorism, gave a speech, a wide-ranging speech that looked at how we can keep our country safe, how he has already kept our country safe. There have been countless plots disrupted. He writes about terrorist networks that have been destroyed, and how he has confronted the threat for 7 years. Does he have a plan that is working? Hillary Clinton, on the other hand, says that we are not winning the fight against terrorism. Donald Trump has said some pretty amazing things, as he tends to do, including the the New York Times analyzed every public utterance by Mr. Trump over the past week to explore the hold that he has on the Republican electorate. We'll talk about what he has had to say and why he has this hold on the Republican electorate. But Ted Cruz is moving up in the polls and has come in close second to Trump in a recent poll. We will talk about him. We'll talk about Cruz quite a bit. We will look at Bernie Sanders some and why it is that he's been relatively quiet lately, hasn't he? We'll talk about that because our guest is a political columnist. We'll look at the climate talks in Paris because of all that's happened in California. And earlier the following week in Colorado, we haven't focused a lot of attention on climate talks, so we'll talk about how those are going as well. So here's our phone number. Join the conversation. What did you think of the presidential address last night? Did he outline a plan to combat terrorism? Do you think that he was forceful enough? The plan that he laid out, the four things that we should do and the things that we should not do. We welcome your thoughts on his address, important address from the Oval Office. Our phone number for Kathy is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we are on Twitter as well, and that's at K Dunn Show. Hi, Kathy. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, how are you?
Enjoyed your performance at the debate. We'll talk a little bit later about how nerve-wracking that was because everything changed at the last minute. We'll get to that. But first, let's talk about the presidential address last night. Fairly short, he had been criticized for underestimating the threat of terrorism. Did he reassure the American people? Did he give us a plan that seems viable?
Well, maybe on the first, I don't think quite so much on the second, and I do think that he was trying to reassure people, but I don't think he really offered much new in the way of concrete plans. I think that the Obama administration has been criticized, and we've heard a lot of criticism on the campaign trail from Republicans about his lack of a coherent policy. Foreign policy in general, and also in specific dealing with ISIS, and I do think that that is something that we have yet to see, you know, a really concrete plan for dealing with these attacks, especially the kind, you know, these DIY attacks, as they're starting to call them, these homegrown terrorists who are not necessarily being directed by somebody, you know, in Syria or Iraq, but in fact are taking it upon themselves to forward this jihadist cause.
It must be incredibly, incredibly difficult to figure out where these kinds of attacks may come from.
Yeah, and, you know, I think that one of the central disagreements among Republicans in this race is how far you go with electronic surveillance that, mm-hmm. in fact, may be one of the clues toward, you know, figuring out where, you know, as people are starting to perhaps reach out to the jihadist movement, starting to make comments on the, you know, on their social media. But, you know, who do you target? And, you know, that's the other sort of central issue here. Do you target American Muslims, as some Republican candidates are suggesting, who are, you know, by all accounts, law-abiding and, you know, show no signs of radicalization? Do you watch them anyway? And, you know, what are the constitutional consequences of that, the constitutional limits of that?
Mm-hmm. He did talk about the no-fly list, and you can be on a no-fly list and still you can go and buy a gun in this country. And, of course, Congress did not deal with that last week. That seems like a fairly sensible thing. There are other things that we'll talk about. But why is that politically controversial, do you think, Kathy?
Well, I think that anything related to gun control,
yes.
is politically controversial.
Right.
You know, we've heard Republicans here in Iowa, including Iowa's governor this morning, say that the president made a mistake by sort of going back to gun control as the issue here. He says, the Governor Brand said here, a Republican said, that's just divisive. What he should have done is focus on issues that can help unify the country and use this attack, as happened after September 11th, to try to focus on things that both Republicans and Democrats can work together on to help unite the country behind something. Gun control is apparently not that thing.
Mm-hmm. And yet we're reaching the point where in less than a week we had the incident in Colorado and then in California. I mean, it's getting to be almost too much to bear, isn't it? In 5 days, in 6 days, you have two mass shootings.
Yeah, I think it's really hard for people to absorb.
And, yes.
And, you know, I do think that these gun control issues are probably, you know, less controversial in the general public than they are among the people who are really acutely politically involved and politically aware. And, you know, a lot of these, you know, the really polarized, you know, absolutely do nothing at all on, you know, related to guns type of attitude, I think, you know, is more... I think that's more entrenched with the political class than it is with the average citizen.
Mm-hmm. We're hearing from Republican candidates and from some in the country now quite a bit of anti-Muslim rhetoric. The president, quite forcefully last night, did say ISIL does not speak for Islam. There are a billion Muslims around the world. The vast majority of victims are Muslim. It's an extremist ideology within Islam that has spread against, and we have to do something about those horrific interpretations of Islam, and Muslim countries need to do something as well. He was fairly strong on that, I thought.
You know, what's interesting is that the rhetoric on the Republican side from presidential candidates has a lot to do with religious liberty and, you know, attacking the Obama administration for, you know, what they consider to be attacks on Christianity and religious liberty. And at the same time, they are saying that same, you know, concern about religious liberty is not, they're not applying that to Islam, in part because they say, Rick Santorum, I interviewed him last week, he said, because of the component of Sharia law, which is a secular, ish type of, or political at least, mode of living that can be tied to the jihadist movement. They're arguing they don't want to extend all of those same concerns about religious liberty to Islam. It's a very interesting distinction that they're trying to make there.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure you saw the piece in the New York Times yesterday about Donald Trump, and you have interviewed Donald Trump, so I'm interested in your personal thoughts about him. But, you know, it's one comment after another. This comment on Thursday night, something bad is happening, something really dangerous is going on, the link between the shootings in San Bernardino and the president's failure to say radical Islamic terrorism. And then he went on to say there is something going on with him that we don't know about. What in the world was he saying?
Yeah, I'm not sure what it is that he's trying to imply there. You know, Donald Trump doesn't usually mince words, you know.
Right, right.
So if there's something that he's unwilling to spell out, yeah, you have to kind of wonder exactly where this is coming from. Yeah, I do think that Donald Trump goes way beyond, you know, what most other candidates are willing to say about most topics, including the president. So I can't predict where it is he's going with this. We'll have to wait and see. But certainly he is, you know, he was one of the people who held on way beyond just about anybody else in public life to the whole birther conspiracy.
Yes.
For Barack Obama. So who knows what his theory will be this time.
You've interviewed him. What's your takeaway from what he has said to you?
Well, he generally, I think, says the same sort of things in private that he says in public. There's not much of a difference there with Donald Trump. That's what some people like about him, frankly, that he's not worried about offending anyone. He's not worried about making a statement that somebody might consider to be, beyond the pale. And my interactions directly with him, he's always been very friendly to me. He's been, I think, easy to talk to. Fairly direct as far as questions being asked and answered. But, you know, my newspaper hasn't always had a great relationship with him. So, it's been kind of interesting to deal with his campaign on a variety of levels.
I'm sure. And what is his stand now? Because I've read various things that Muslims carry identification cards, that we need to register American Muslims in a database. What is his position?
I think that's a really good question. You know, he has been asked by reporters directly about, having a database of Muslims, of having people carry ID cards. And he gets responses that make it sound like he's agreeing with that. But then when you ask him again directly, he's like, no, I never said that. So he's been kind of cagey about it. I think the one thing he is clear about is that he thinks that it was a mistake for New York City to stop surveilling mosques. New York City did that for a while, felt like it wasn't productive, stopped doing it. Donald Trump says that was a big mistake, that we ought to continue to be watching these mosques. And that's the one thing I think he's been really clear on. The other things are ideas that reporters have floated to him. He says things like, we got to do whatever we can to stop this. It always sounds like he's agreeing with the details of what they're asking, but it just, I think this is not something he's necessarily put forward as his own idea.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about Ted Cruz. You've written about him, and he's doing all right in the polls these days. You say he's been cruising along in the good ship Donald's wake, letting Trump take the heavy artillery for his over-the-top rhetoric, but essentially matching him on general philosophy and key positions. He figures Trump will eventually sink, leaving Cruz as a similar but more seaworthy model. Nice turn of phrase there, Kathy.
Yeah, well, this is seeming to be the way things are going here in Iowa. Ted Cruz, we just saw our first poll in Iowa. It was a Monmouth University poll of Iowa Republican caucus goers showing Cruz in first place.
Really?
With Donald Trump behind him, and then Marco Rubio in third place, and Ben Carson for the first time in a long time in fourth place. Only four candidates in double digits. Ted Cruz is what I see happening here is he's starting to not only begin to unite the evangelical conservatives, which is a really important voting bloc in Iowa, but also some of the other coalitions of Republicans, including Tea Party conservatives. And that's the way you win the caucuses. It's hard to win with just one faction of the party because you, unless you're the only guy, if you're the only guy representing a certain faction of the party, or there's not much competition, you might be able to win the caucuses that way. But generally speaking, you're going to have to unite a couple of factions, the Libertarians, for example, the Tea Party Republicans, the Evangelical Republicans, maybe mainstream or establishment Republicans. I don't see Ted Cruz getting mainstream or establishment Republicans, but he's got at least pieces of the other three coalitions, and that very well could be enough to rocket him to the top for the caucuses.
Interesting. You wrote about, I can't remember where this took place, but GOP candidates blast political correctness was your column, asking to define the greatest moral threat facing the nation. Carson said it was political correctness. Everybody said something else, but by the end of the forum, it seemed as though political correctness was on everybody's mind.
Yeah, it was enemy one. This is right around Thanksgiving, and it was a forum that was dominated by evangelicals. And it was really interesting to hear that. Donald Trump and Ben Carson, I don't remember if Donald Trump was at this particular forum. Ben Carson was, however. And I think what the political correctness phrase is sort of a cue for someone who is perhaps an outsider. You know, the domination of outsiders in the Republican field, the willingness, you know, political correctness, it tends to be lumped in with politician speak, you know, and people who are perhaps not being straight with Americans, and certainly is something that they've accused the Obama administration of. And I think that by talking about political correctness, that's one way that even people who have held office can start to make themselves look, you know, wrap themselves in the mantle of being an outsider.
Mm-hmm. What is all of this constant jitteriness, these shootings that have taken place, this now threat of a kind of terrorism that we didn't see coming in the way we experienced it last week? What does all of it do, do you think, to the presidential race, Kathy?
Well, I think that one thing people may be doing, first of all, and we've seen this throughout the race to some level, focusing more on security, focusing more on foreign policy, focusing less on bread and butter economic issues, and I do think that that tends to benefit or help people who have had some sort of foreign policy experience. So, we started this campaign thinking that governors were going to have the inside track,
yes,
especially on the Republican side because of their executive experience managing and balancing budgets. Now it's looking more like senators, in part because of their economic development. I mean, not economic development, foreign policy experience. And the two guys that I think have had the steepest rise or the most benefit from this in Iowa is Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio. And then on the Democratic side, of course, Hillary Clinton.
Mm-hmm. We're going to welcome phone calls. It's All Things Political you're listening to here on the Ideas Network. And our guest this hour is political columnist for the Des Moines Register. You probably know her face as well because she was one of the moderators for the most recent Democratic presidential debate that took place at Drake University. Kathy Obradovich is with the Des Moines Register, and she is with us to talk about, obviously, Iowa is where it's happening politically, a number of issues. The presidential address last night on terrorism, what you thought of it, how candidates are responding to terrorism and to other issues as well. We have one line open if you'd like to grab it. It is yours. The phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, and that's at K Dunn Show. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls for Kathy, starting with Michael in Plymouth. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Kathleen. So much food for thought. Coming from the state of Joe McCarthy, I won't mince words. I believe that Donald Trump is a dangerous clown, but my comments are more specific to the so-called Christian right. Jerry Falwell Jr. made some comment about Muslims and allowing all the students at his Liberty University to carry firearms.
Yes.
There is one commandment that the Christians seem not to remember. When Christ said, love your enemy, I don't see any Christians following that commandment. So in my opinion, Jerry Falwell and all the Christian rights basically are the Antichrists, because if they're not going to follow the commandment of Christ to love their enemy, then they're not Christian.
Kathy.
Boy, yeah. I don't think I would characterize anybody as Antichrist. I do think that in a lot of politics that people pick and choose the tenets of Christianity that most appeal to their political, their political philosophy, and we certainly see that, and we see that on the Democratic side as well. It's the kind of thing that I think that we have to be wary of in politics, and we have certainly seen this throughout American history, where a group of people become a scapegoat or be demonized for something that is going wrong in our society or in the world, and that is something that I do take seriously. And as I watch this anti-Muslim rhetoric rise up, I worry about that happening again in the United States.
Thank you very much for the call, Michael. Let's go to Phil in Illinois. Hi, Phil.
Good afternoon to you and your guest, Kathleen.
Hi, Phil.
I've got a simple question for you. I read the New York Times yesterday, and they had it was either online or in the paper. They were talking about the request for a use of force proclamation that the president has asked the Congress for, and it has very strict limitations on the type of force that can be used, and it has a 3-year term. In lieu of him making the next Democratic president that he said we'll have deal with his policies only and giving himself a third term, why would he need a 3-year term when he's only got 1 year left?
That's a really good question, and I don't know why the 3-year term was part of that, except perhaps it would give the next president, whoever it is, time to decide what his or her policy would be without having to immediately negotiate with Congress for another. Another authorization for force. I would expect that the next president, whoever it is, to bring in his or her own ideas for dealing with this terrorist threat. But it is a difficult task dealing with Congress, and that person probably will end up appreciating having a little bit of time, at least on to be able to carry out some of the military action that's already underway.
Mm-hmm. He did talk about working to get a ceasefire in Syria. He also talked about and was taken to task by the NBC foreign affairs correspondent for helping to train and arm those rebel forces in Syria that are taking on Assad. There doesn't seem to be any indication that that's working very well. It's a mess, isn't it? The people that we did train, you read a few months ago, just kind of fell apart. There doesn't seem to be an organization that we can get right behind and know that it's going to do the job.
Yeah, there's a vast difference of opinion, too, about which groups of people
right.
on the ground there that we ought to be training and working with. We train and arm one group that ends up, not being particularly friendly to the United States. We might, not be working enough with the Kurds. Some Republicans say, oh, we should be, it's the Kurds who are really going to be able to do the job against ISIS. They're the ones we ought to be, spending time and money with. And it is a vast difference of opinion about who exactly are the friendlies on the ground.
Here's a Facebook comment from Marlene on the president's speech. It seems like everything the president says or does, the GOP has all the answers. So if they have all the answers, why don't they share the great ideas with the president and work out the answers instead of knocking him? The Republicans are not trying to work united, and it's really sad.
That's politics. I think both sides say that the other side won't listen and won't work together. And, each side can point to examples of when they've offered ideas and have been ignored, I think. And that is really part of the problem with our political process and part of the reason why, as voters are listening to presidential candidates, you know, with their great ideas about what they're going to do, they really have to understand that whoever the next president is coming into a broken political climate in Washington. Mm-hmm. The first thing they're going to have to do is try to fix some of that.
Mm-hmm. You do think, and particularly remembering what today was in history, Pearl Harbor Day, that you do wish in this time when there is a threat from this very extremist kind of ideology, and it's so hard to track who these people are, and you really need a worldwide coordinated effort, but it would be so nice to have people coming together in this country to figure out Republicans and Democrats and presidential candidates, for that matter. Let's hear all of your ideas. We need to counter this.
You know, the United States is at war, but war in the 21st century is a whole lot different than what we had during World War II.
Yes.
And, you know, the identifiable threat to our country, you know, when Japan came and bombed Pearl Harbor was obvious. You know, it was absolutely obvious who the enemy was and what, you know, ultimately we were going to have to do about it. And in 21st century warfare, where the enemy isn't necessarily another foreign state, the enemy is some sort of subset, smaller group. It is much harder to figure out exactly who is the enemy, where they are,
right,
and how to go after them.
Yeah. Phil, thanks very much for your call. Let's go to Mike in Madison. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks. Donald Trump, he's a conspiracy coal stoker. He sits back, tosses a piece of coal onto the firebox, and watches all the radicals get all excited, and it's a bunch of news coverage of it. Every once in a while, he'll take a big shovel full of coal and toss it onto the fire, and these people just eat it up. There's a possibility that he could become president. I mean, Hulk Hogan became a governor, and look where Ronald Reagan went right to the White House. So certainly there's a possibility, but I hope he doesn't make it. In regard to the gun control, I think we need to be looking at the accessories. We need to look at the magazine capacity. The Second Amendment was the right to keep and bear arms. For a well-regulated militia, it did not specifically at that time. The founding fathers could not conceptualize guns that could have 20, 30 round capacity. They were still dealing with muskets, and I think we need to look at that part of the of this incredibly difficult task in front of us and regulate that. I'm a hunter, and I can shoot a deer with one shot. I can hit two ducks with two. And my clips only hold 6 rounds. And anybody that shoots a lot knows that once you start, shooting in rapid fire, the barrel heats up and it starts wobbling around, and your accuracy goes way down. We don't need guns that can shoot more than 6. And I think that's where we need to look at this whole debate.
Thank you, Mike, for your call. Kathy?
Yeah, well, so on the gun control issue, what's interesting is a lot of the rhetoric looks at, the fact that Colorado, where the Planned Parenthood shooting was a couple of weeks ago, and also San Bernardino, California, both have pretty strong gun control laws, stronger certainly than we probably have here in Iowa or other places around the country. And yet, whoever the bad actors were able to get their hands on these guns. Well, the thing is that state gun control laws are pretty ineffective, I think, if somebody can go on the Internet and order a weapon without having to have a background check, or they can cross the border and go to a gun show without having to have a background check. It's also the concern I have about all the talk about mental illness and how we're going to, work on mental illness in this country, which is definitely needed. But, we're also going to somehow keep guns away from people who have dangerous mental illnesses. Well, how are we going to do that without serious background checks, right? I do think that some of the discussion about, local gun control laws not stopping these mass shootings, there's some holes in that argument, because I think that nationally we've created these loopholes that allow people to circumvent our local laws.
And Mike makes a point, not that it will ever be debated in this country, at least not during my lifetime, but do you need a gun that fires more than 6 rounds? Do you need to sell these kinds of assault weapons in this country? Why would you need to? I mean, it's a legitimate question, is it not?
Well, it's a question, I think, that is answered by the fact that some of the people who are most staunch about gun rights are not worried about being able to hunt. They're not worried about being able to carry a pistol for personal protection. What they're worried about is that somehow they're going to end up having to fight the U.S. government. Somehow the government is going to get, the democracy is going to collapse or whatever, that the government is going to be the one that is the enemy here. And, of course, the government has all of the military-grade weapons. Mm-hmm. And so that's going to be, somehow that is going to be the issue. And, I don't think that most Americans think that way. We had a situation in 2000 where the presidential race had to go to the Supreme Court. We didn't have armed insurrection as a result. I don't see that as a primary concern, but I think that is what drives a lot of the concerned about people wanting to protect the right to have these military-type weapons.
Mm-hmm. We haven't talked very much about the Democrats. Kathy, let's do so. Bernie Sanders has been really quiet lately. Where is he?
Where is he?
Yeah.
Well, I think that he has been out on the campaign trail, but I have not heard too much. He has not been in Iowa the last couple of weeks. Hmm. Hillary Clinton has been in Iowa. She was here last week. She's coming back middle of this week. And she is she's maintaining the lead in Iowa. She hasn't really grown it a whole lot in Iowa. What Bernie Sanders needs to be doing, I think, in Iowa is making sure that he is building an organization that can help him perform better than his poll numbers in Iowa.
Mm-hmm. Let's go next to Marty in Douglas County. Hi, Marty.
Hi, Kathleen. Hey, sorry to go back into the gun issue again, but if the candidates really want to be rounding up the people responsible for these mass murders, they need to get the white males registered, because they're the ones who are killing most of the people in these incidences. I'm sure I'm not the only one who saw this in the paper yesterday. 45 people have been killed by jihadis since 9/11. 48 people have been killed by white supremacist groups. Over 200,000 people have been murdered in this country since 9/11. We are looking completely askew at the real problem.
Kathy.
I don't necessarily want to generalize that this is somehow a white male problem. I do think that when we look at gun mass shootings that are not related to jihadists or some sort of organized group, that mental illness is an issue that we have. I think it allowed a lot of people who are, they're marginalized for some reason, and we're letting them slip through the cracks in a lot of ways in our society. And even separate from the gun issue, I do think that this is something we need to look at in our society and finding ways, first of all, why is this happening so much, and why, what can we do as a society? But I really hesitate to, make it about, generalizing that a one racial group or one group, is going to be, primarily responsible. This is such a huge group of people and such a minority that ever get involved in this kind of activity.
Does it behoove the Democrats, and Hillary Clinton in particular, because Bernie Sanders has a not as strong a record on gun control, does it behoove Hillary Clinton to make the issue of gun accessibility, types of guns available, front and center in her campaign? Is it a rallying point for Democrats?
This is an important point for Democrats, and one of the things that we heard after the first Democratic presidential debate was that even Democrats who like Bernie Sanders a whole lot and can see themselves supporting Bernie Sanders are concerned about him being possibly soft on gun control. And so this is an opportunity for Hillary Clinton to, you know, pressure this, you know, and also perhaps keep the argument, if you keep it on gun control, then you're not talking about Wall Street regulation, which is where Bernie Sanders is
right.
strong and
mm-hmm.
Hillary Clinton is perceived to be weaker.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, so to the extent that she feels like she needs to go after Bernie Clinton or Bernie Sanders, gun control is a good issue for that. However, I'm not detecting right now, at least, that she feels like she really has to go after him. She needs Bernie Sanders supporters to support her in the general election. And so, you know, to the extent that, you know, she can stay ahead of him without really going heavily on the attack, I think that that would be the way that she would prefer to handle her campaign.
Mm. She needs Barack Obama supporters to turn out for her, too. Will she get them?
You know, it's interesting, and there are certainly Barack, you know, the vast majority of Democrats in Iowa are, I would call them Barack Obama supporters. And so they're going to be divided among the candidates. And, you know, she's not going to consolidate Barack Obama supporters, I don't think. What she will do, I think, is at this point at least be able to get, a substantial cross-section. She does draw some from the liberal side of the party, and that's good because they're the most active and the ones who are most likely to work for a campaign. But also, you know, what she needs to do is also start building a coalition that will help her win Iowa in November.
Mm-hmm. Marty, thanks so much for your call. Rod in Weyerhaeuser. Hi.
Yeah, thanks, Kathleen. Good show. Another one. And anyhow, I'm just saying, you know, there's so many darn problems. And, of course, you know, you listen to the news. I listen to the all the time. I listen to the conservatives, so-called conservatives, and I listen to the evangelicals, you know, because, you know, a lot of that influence of religion, the Christian right has a lot. I'm Christian, by the way. But I'm just saying how it influences. Now, you see this right to arms, for instance, AK-47, whatever. You know, these people that want these guns, not necessarily mean that they're somebody that's going to go out and shoot a bunch of people. I mean, I can see the side on both sides of it, the fact, because, you know, somebody that's going to take a gun for hunting, they know they don't need it. But somebody that lives now, like, in the city, and you got rough stuff going on like that, you know, they should probably have a right to have one if they want to protect their people. Because, you know, when these things happen, if, you know, you one-shot pistol 38 special or whatever ain't going to stand much of a chance. I mean, one shot does the job, but if there's six of them, you know what I mean. And another thing with these refugees is that fact that the conservatives are making fun about John Kerry with the refugees because they're moving out because of global warming. So, you know, that's what I mean. You listen to the news and you get pains in your stomach, you know.
Right. All right. Kathy, you have pains in your stomach?
Well, I think that the idea that more and more people who aren't necessarily trained to deal with armed combat are walking around with semi-automatics, that does not make me feel safer. And I understand that part of the argument here on gun control from the conservative side is that what we need is actually more guns, that somehow you know, if we have people who are going to put up resistance to these random, you know, shootings, that that it will deter them essentially and make us all safer. But you know, you look at the stats, and I don't have them right at my fingertips, of people who have been killed by gun accidents, by suicide, and it, you know, those types of gun fatalities are really significant in the United States, and having more and more access to more and more powerful weapons just doesn't, mm-hmm. you know, it doesn't particularly make me feel safer.
It's 90 people a day, isn't it?
It's
a lot of people. Yeah. Rod, thank you so much for your call. You're listening to All Things Political here on the Ideas Network. And Kathy Obradovich is our guest. She is a political columnist for the Des Moines Register. And she was one of the moderators in the Democratic presidential debate that was just held at Drake University in Iowa. She wrote some interesting things, speaking of terrorism, as we've spent a lot of this hour talking about that. She was, as you can imagine, preparing for this interview and thinking of follow-up questions to the questions she was going to ask, and then everything changed the night before the debate because of the attacks in Paris. And so she wrote about that and what that was like and what it was like to be a moderator for that debate. I want to get to that, too. We'll take a couple calls and ask her to tell us that story. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go back to phone calls. Jerry in La Crosse. Hi, Jerry.
Hi. Thank you.
Sure.
I'm trying to make my mind up about the political issue of whether to let Muslim refugees into our country. And I know both sides seem to have sort of a knee-jerk reaction. I think the left sort of saying, well, you know, it's not an American way to hold them out. And the right says, you know, basically we should protect our borders. But I wish you would expand that conversation a little bit to include the basic values of the USA and whether they conflict with the basic values of Islam. Number one would be freedom of speech. You know the problems we've had with people displaying pictures or using the name of Muhammad wrong. Is that a basic problem that we are always going to have? Number two is the separation of church and state. When I look around the world and I think of the Philippines, I think of Thailand, I think of northern Myanmar, I think northern Malaysia, I mean. I think of parts of Indonesia, Turkey today, Russia, Chechnya, China, Kashgar. All these are conflicts between Islam and the government because the Islamic people want to have, a combination of government and church. Should those things be considered when we're considering letting these people into the country?
Kathy.
Well, first of all, I don't think that you can generalize to all Muslims saying that they don't value free speech, that they don't want women to have civil rights, all of those things that get pointed out as differences. You certainly that is true of these radical Muslims and the ISIS movement. Some of the Islamic countries, in fact, do have this as part of their legal system, there's also millions of American Muslims who live under the Constitution of the United States, who uphold the Constitution of the United States, who want the freedoms that are offered here, and then they also want the freedom to worship and practice Islam as a peaceful religion. And, you know, we have a Muslim man who is a state legislator in Iowa. He is a strong advocate of people's constitutional freedoms in the United States. And so I really feel uncomfortable when we start generalizing to all Muslims and all sects of Muslims based on what we see from ISIS and from some of the sort of hardline Muslim countries.
All right, let's talk about that debate for a moment. You wrote a really interesting piece, Kathy. You were on the air for the first rehearsal the day before Saturday's presidential debate. You hear this voice over your earpiece telling you what and then what changed in terms of debate preparation.
Yeah, so what we heard, we only had two rehearsals, one the day before the debate, one the day of the debate, in the hall where this was happening at Drake University. And one of the producers or directors over our earpieces told us that there had been an armed attack in Paris. And at that point, we knew very little about it. And so we immediately grabbed our phones and started looking for news about this, and there wasn't very much yet. But by that evening, of course, we realized that this was, in fact, coordinated attacks, a major terrorist event. And we also, CBS News, which is the main sponsor for this debate, John Dickerson, the main moderator, they at that point were ripping up the entire, all the questions for this 2-hour debate, and rethinking the format, deciding what, how to go about it. I went to bed Friday night before the debate, not knowing for sure if I, as a panelist, would actually still be on, the debate, because I wouldn't have been surprised if they had decided to say, this is going to be a one-topic debate, terrorism, and we're going to get rid of all the sort of extraneous stuff. And, this was really mostly, the CBS and CBS News and John Dickerson and his staff did all the heavy lifting on this. They were really incredible and did an amazing job. But it just sort of added to the, uncertainty and, anxiety going into this national debate.
And you think about all the work. That's not an easy thing to do. You have to do follow-up questions. You spent a lot of time preparing for all of this.
Right.
And then you found yourself, you say, researching a possible new debate question on bioterrorism as it relates to Iowa's agriculture industry.
Yeah, so, I hardly slept the night before. So I was up at dawn, thinking, okay, well, if this is going to be, because I didn't know at that point, if this is going to be a totally, terrorism and foreign policy debate, what might I be able to ask that relates directly to Iowa? And so I started looking at, issues that came up after September 11th and bioterror and the food safety of the food supply was one thing that I came up with that would have been an interesting question. I would have liked to heard the candidate answer.
Yes,
but ultimately that one didn't make the cut.
Mm-hmm. And you talk about how many people were involved in this. It was a whole lot of people from quite a few organizations.
Yeah, there were several co-sponsors. So the Des Moines Register was a co-sponsor of the debate, along with KCCI-TV, which is the local CBS affiliate. We were also working with Drake University. They had a huge heavy lift dealing with their campus facilities here. CBS, of course, the main player. And then the Democratic National Committee, they did all the ticketing and all that kind of stuff, the press credentialing, and also our local Iowa Democratic Party was involved. So, and also Twitter was a sponsor. So there were a ton of people involved. There were, I would say, probably literally hundreds of people who had at least some role in this debate.
And why, Kathy, to the best of your understanding, did they have this on a darn Saturday night? Really?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think I don't know how the scheduling worked. If that was a DNC decision, or how the debate got scheduled. There were, it was. I think what I saw was for the ratings, about 8.5 million people watched the debate. So yeah, it was on. There was football on.
Right.
And but also, this came after a major terror attack, and I think people were interested in hearing what the candidates had to say about it.
Interesting point. Do you have any little tidbits of what happened when the cameras were off?
One little thing that I think wasn't apparent to people who weren't watching it on TV, the candidates came out for a photo op before the debate, and then they were sent backstage again for the opener. And as they were leaving the stage, I could hear Hillary Clinton. Her mic was still live, and I don't think everybody in the auditorium could hear her, but she said, "Wow, is that it? That was the easiest debate I've ever been on." And I think Martin O'Malley, I think it was him who responded, "Yeah, let's go home." So they're just kind of joking with each other on their way off the stage before the debate actually started.
They are still so far from home, aren't they? Well, the caucus is coming up pretty soon now.
Yeah, so February 1st will be the caucuses. It's interesting because 4 years ago and also 8 years ago, the caucuses were right after the new year in January. This time it feels like we have a little extra time.
Mm-hmm.
So what we're anticipating is we may not have all of the candidates caucus campaigning right through the holidays. They may actually get to take a break from Iowa, especially during Christmas,
mm-hmm.
which did not really happen 4 years ago.
Yeah. Kathy, thank you very much for being with us. I so enjoyed the hour. Thanks.
Thanks for having me, Kathleen. I always enjoy talking to you.
Thanks. Kathy Obradovich, a political columnist for the Des Moines Register, and she helped to moderate the most recent presidential debate in Iowa. She covers Iowa state government, politics, the Iowa caucuses, and, of course, has been doing a whole lot of presidential campaign reporting, considering the importance of Iowa, which has caucuses on February 1st, just around the corner. Thanks very much to Scotty Myers and KP Whaley for producing this program, and thanks, everybody, for all of your calls. If we didn't get to you, please leave a message on Facebook about all that we talked about, because then the conversation can go on. That's the Kathleen Dunn Show. We have news coming up momentarily from National Public Radio, and then we'll talk about football. Do you think we're going to see football in this country 10 years from now?